Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl, and this is the Deviant Legion Network, and we're doing an in memoriam to Hal Holbrook. My co-host today is Limes Marshall. Limes co-host our show, Terror with a Twist of Limes. Say hello, Limes.
Good evening, everybody.
And today, our special guest is author Mark DeWitziak. He's written several books on Columbo and a number of things, but also he knew Hal Holbrook rather well. And so I'm just going to pass it over to you, Mark, and tell us a little bit about Hal and how you met him and what your thoughts are on him and your memories of
him. Well, the thoughts are in a bit of a turmoil this week because it has been quite an emotional roller coaster, as you might imagine. Hal meant the world to me, and I can't believe he's gone. I mean, I when somebody who is 95, and Hal would have been 96 in just a couple of weeks, it's not like it intellectually is a stunning moment or something, but Hal was so strong for so long that it just seemed like he'd go on forever. So, I mean, the notion that he's not here and there's not another opportunity to talk and laugh and catch up is it still hasn't quite registered in my brain that's the case, because he was just such a warm, wonderful person. I cannot stress warm enough. he just radiated warmth, and he just retired the show, the Mark Twain show. He did the one man Mark Twain show for 63 years, and he retired starting in 1954.
Wow.
So when he retired the show in 2017 from regularly touring, and he was doing about 40 Mark Twain dates a year all the way at the end. Can you imagine just standing on your feet in your 90s for 2 hours, let alone doing a one-man show to the level of artistry that he did it all that time? It really just – that's why I say you really did get the impression that he would go on forever. And, you know, when Hal was in his 80s, he fell at an airport on his way to do a date, and he fractured his hip. And for so many people who are in their 80s, you know, a fractured hip sometimes is the beginning of the end. Hal was on his feet performing as Mark Twain like a few weeks later. He immediately tackled this regiment of getting himself back in shape and getting himself back on stage. So he was just an amazing guy that way. And we met in the mid-80s. We met about 35 years ago. And we met at a press event. It was a reception in a hotel ballroom. And I had walked in, and he was standing off in a quiet corner, and another critic was interviewing him. And so I kind of sidled up there, you know, like in the on-deck position to say, like, well, I'm next. And waiting for this this colleague, another TV critic, to get done asking him questions. And eventually this fellow snapped off his tape recorder and walked off in search of other interviews, and I stepped in, hoping that I could maintain some semblance of journalistic integrity, and not let that fanboy who was lurking right beneath the surface come bubbling up and start babbling like a complete idiot. You know, but I managed to introduce myself and not lose it completely. And we bonded very, very quickly, not surprisingly, over our mutual love and admiration for Mark Twain. And I got to tell him that seeing him perform Mark Twain in the CBS special in 1967, when CBS aired the 90-minute version of Mark Twain Tonight, seeing that, was just a, and I was about 10 years old. It was just a revelation I didn't understand it all at that age, but all I knew that here was Mark Twain, and it was Mark Twain. It wasn't Hal Holbrook. I didn't even know who Hal Holbrook was at that moment. Here was Mark Twain alive and funny and profound and amazing, and it brought Mark Twain alive in a way that no other author could have ever been brought alive for anybody. And I then in high school fell under the spell of reading Twain. I just started reading everything I could. And all during that time, I had got all three of Hal's record albums. He had done three albums of material as Mark Twain. And I listened to those backwards and forwards. And then when I went away to college in 1974, the following year, Hal brought a one-man show, Mark Twain Tonight, to the Kennedy Center. And I got to watch. I got student tickets. I sat up way up in the – it was at the Opera House at the Kennedy Center. I sat way up with the Angels in the nosebleed territory. But I didn't care because I was in the same place and watching him perform as Mark Twain. If the CBS special of Mark Twain Tonight ignited my sort of sparked my interest in Mark Twain, then seeing him perform as Twain in 75 took that spark and fanned it into a brush fire. Because after that, I was just completely enamored. And then in 1979, so like 4 years after I had seen him, I started performing. At 22, I started performing as Mark Twain on stage. And then about 6 years after that, we're at this reception, and I get to tell him all of this and sort of explain to him just how much he meant to me, how much I love Mark Twain. And we kind of got each other worked up. It was kind of like where two or more are gathered. And we started talking about Mark Twain, and we started getting really, really ardently enthusiastic. The conversation was just growing to a fever pitch. And all of a sudden, he grew quiet. He grew very, very quiet. And he looked down at the glass in his hand. And he sort of raised his gaze, and he met my gaze, and he held it. And he looked at me under an arched eyebrow, which was a look I was going to get to know very well, a very endearing look. And he said, "You do realize I don't think I'm Mark Twain, right?" And I immediately said, "Well, of course, you know." Now I had acted some at this point, and I said, the oldest maxim in the theater is that you can't get lost in a part. If you start to think you are the role you're playing, you're lost as an actor. You're done as an actor. So I said, number one, you could not continue to brilliantly interpret Mark Twain if you actually were overwhelmed by the part. I said, that's number one. I said, number two, I love Hal Holbrook as an actor because of the entire actor. And I started rattling off his credits, saying, Deep Throat and All the President's Men, That Certain Summer, Pueblo, Sandberg's Lincoln, Murder by Natural Causes, Creep Show, all these wonderful performances that I knew him from. And I he was just kind of a little bit, overwhelmed but pleased, because he put his hand on my shoulder and just sort of looked at me and nodded his head as if to say, "You get it. You do understand." And this was the Casablanca moment. This was the moment at the end of Casablanca. we began working.
Round up the usual suspects.
No. This looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Okay.
This is the very last line of Casablanca. Louis, this looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And that's what it was. That's exactly what it was. So it was the beginning of a lot of conversation. Every time I was in Los Angeles, we would have lunch or dinner, or he'd have me come up to the house in Beverly Hills. One of the beautiful things about, if you were Hal Holbrook's friend, you were Dixie Carter's friend. So I got to be very good friends with Dixie as well, who is just a, a wonderful person, warm in a different way, but very much, but very warm as well. And we would, and if he came to Cleveland or he came to anywhere in Northeast Ohio or sometimes in New York, we would meet up. I saw the show as many, I lost count how many times I saw Mark Twain tonight. And people would say, like, well, how could you see it over and over again? And I said, because it's never the same show. That's why. Hal changed. What a lot of people don't realize is that Hal always was tinkering and changing the show. He would take some pieces out and put some things back in, and he would always wanted the show to reflect the times. So he was never just had like 2 hours of material that he did. It was always there. I saw it at least 15 times. I don't know really exactly how many, but I saw it in New York. I saw it in Tennessee. I saw it in Ohio, you know, and everywhere I saw it, and every time I saw it, it was a different show. And Hal estimated towards the end that he had gone through somewhere between 16 to 18 hours of Twain material. And you see, I perform as Twain. I have about 6 hours of material committed to memory. And I can, you know, take some things in, put them out on the fly. But I'm a piker. I've been playing Twain for 43 years, and I'm a piker compared to Hal, who went through 18 hours of material. So, you know, that, if you want to start with that as far as Hal's importance as an actor, it is certainly the greatest accomplishment and the thing he's always going to be the best known for. And in some ways, that's appropriate because you could go all the way back to the Greeks and not find anything the equal to this. One actor living with one role for 63 years. I mean, think about that. I mean, first of all,
longer than Mark Twain. Yeah, longer than Mark Twain ever lived.
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, he played Mark Twain for 63 years. Mark Twain lived to be 74. So, but here's the thing you have to know is Samuel Clemens adopted the pen name Mark Twain in 1863 in the Nevada Territory at the Territorial Enterprise. So he became Mark Twain in 1863, and he died in April of 1910. So if you're keeping score at home, that means that Samuel Clemens was Mark Twain for 47 of his 74 years on the planet. Hal Holbrook started playing Mark Twain in 1954. He retired the show in 2017, which is 63 years. So Hal Holbrook was Mark Twain longer than Mark Twain was Mark Twain.
Mark Twain.
So
he
had a longer run as Mark Twain than Samuel Clemens did. And you have to understand that one of the reasons this show is so important is just because, A, it is a great piece of theatrical history, and it is a great theatrical to live with one role, not just one role, but an ever-changing show. Nobody is ever going to match that. but first off, you have to live long enough to perform something for 63 years. So as an adult, if you start at 20, you have to pretty much say you're going to live to be 83 and performing all that time. So it's an amazing – but the other great accomplishment of Hal's career as far as Twain is that Hal Holbrook was a living piece of Mark Twain scholarship. And what I mean by that is we have no recordings of Mark Twain's voice, none, which is somewhat remarkable considering that he lived in an age when everybody was being recorded. And we have recordings of almost everybody around Twain, everybody who was near him or surrounded him, like Theodore Roosevelt and Booker T. Washington. But we don't have Twain. And it's not because he didn't make recordings. He did. He made a lot of them. They all went up in a warehouse fire not too long after his death. And since then, we have no substantiated recordings of Mark Twain's voice. So Hal Holbrook put together his characterization of Mark Twain starting in 1954. Twain died in 1910. That's only 44 years. So there were a lot of people still alive who knew Mark Twain and who knew what he sounded like and how he moved and what his timing was like. And they all helped Hal get his characterization right. So what you have is like people like Twain's daughter, Clara, his one surviving child, Clara, is still alive. Twain's private secretary, Isabel Lyon, is still alive. The son of Twain's lecture manager, Bim Pond, is still alive. And they are all helping Holbrook get it right. Yeah, so the reason we think we know what Mark Twain sounded like and how he moved and how he delivered a line is because of Hal Holbrook. So this is more than just a performance. This is also a piece of scholarship.
Yeah, it's a piece of history,
it is. It is.
Well, in many ways, it's a living biography.
Right. There you go. Yeah,
it's a living biography.
You know, one thing to say about the way Hal Holbrook performed Mark Twain is Hal Holbrook was able to do material as a performer that Mark Twain himself could not do. Mark Twain was a very popular platform performer on the lecture circuit in his lifetime. He was one of the most popular. He was the leading stand-up comic of his day. When Twain died, his reputation was sort of as this kind of grandfatherly, avuncular humorist, the family author, the author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and the person with the wisecracks. And he's kind of, in the same league with Benjamin Franklin, people like that. Well, the truth is, in the 1960s, a lot of Twain's suppressed writing started to come out. And Hal started to perform it. And what we found out was that there was a lot more to this guy than we thought, and that there was this very insightful social critic talking about war and talking about prejudice and talking about lynching and talking about all of these things that Twain himself could not perform on the platform at the time. But Hal could. And did. So Hal also kind of helped us understand Mark Twain as a social critic and as a much more complex writer than we ever thought he was. So, if Mark Twain was good to Hal Holbrook, and that's true, he undoubtedly was, then Hal Holbrook was good to Mark Twain.
Nice. I did, it's funny, you mentioned seeing the 1967 special, and you and I are basically the same age. I think a year younger than you.
I'm 64.
I remember seeing that also. And it didn't really hit me as far as Twain or anything like that, but what it did hit me is that one person is doing this for that long, and memorizing all that, good God.
It's amazing because, that aired in 1967, right? So he had started touring the show in 1954. So that's only 13 years later. It's only 13 years after he started. He's going to perform Mark Twain for another 50 years after that.
Oh,
God. It's like that special is not even halfway through this amazing run of playing Mark Twain. And one of those things, it was like this moment where the show was formalized and put on. And again, it relied only 90 minutes of material compared to all of the material that he did. You're flabbergasted at the amount of material he put in. And right to the end, we would have discussions about this over dinner or over the phone. He'd say, "I'm thinking about putting in a piece about
the way people are just overrun by the money fever and the, how they worship the almighty dollar. What do you think about that? You know, it's just like, somebody once asked me, by the way, they said, have you ever performed as Mark Twain in front of Hal Holbrook? Have you ever done Mark Twain for Hal Holbrook? And I always said to them, would you show Picasso your drawings?
Yeah.
No. No, I've never had the temerity to do my Mark Twain. We've discussed interpretation. We have discussed performance. But I said, I've never said, hey, listen to this to him. I said, but what I have done is I will imitate Hal Holbrook for Hal Holbrook. Not Mark Twain, but Hal Holbrook. And he always got a tremendous – Hal had a great laugh. And there were two lines I would always imitate of his for him. One was a line
Can I guess one?
Did you ever
ask him to call you Billy?
No. No, that's not one of the lines.
Ah, damn it.
It's not Creepshow.
Although I love Creepshow. Matter of fact, Sarah and Becky and I just rewatched The Crate two nights ago in honor of one was the last line from a TV movie written by the Columbo co-creators Levinson and Link, Murder by Natural Causes. Mm. And I can't tell you what the line is because I ruined the movie for you if I did. And I ruined it for anybody who's not seen it. But it's a great last line. So everybody go out and see Murder by Natural Causes and then imagine me impersonating that line for Hal Holbrook. But the other line, which I will do for you, was from All the President's Men, which is one of the moments where they're meeting in the garage. Bob Woodward, played by Robert Redford, is talking to Deep Throat. And he's trying to explain that they're beginning to think about how big the conspiracy is. And he says that they have met with this little attorney who ran a dirty tricks thing for the White House named Donald Segretti. And Deep Throat is trying to explain this goes a lot bigger than any of that. And Hal's got this line where he says, don't tell me you think this was all the doing of little Donald Segretti. And he just spits out the word little Donald Segretti with so much venom and contempt. And that line I would impersonate Hal to him for. And he'd always, that laugh of his, which was just take you back a foot when he did it. So those were, like I said, he had such distinctive delivery. And again, there's so many performances. You mentioned Creepshow, and The Crate is one, not only because of Hal, but because of Fritz Weaver, too.
Another lovely man.
And the two of them together are so good in The Crate. Hal came to view the horror movies he did as a mistake, which, I used to argue with him about. But I think Hal thought, the horror movies kind of hurt his reputation at a point where he could be moving into doing other kinds of roles. And, it kind of diminished the choices he got a little bit. I don't know. He may have been right about that. But like some actors,
I'm glad he did them.
Oh, me too. Listen, and in retrospect, it's like, well, The Fog and Creepshow are, two movies which they're really great, terrific performances. And I think that they have now look really good on his resume because they show he had a move that a lot of actors didn't have or couldn't have. That's the kind of thing about Hal is the type of actor whose stature grows the more you look at what he did. When you start to put the whole resume together and you start to look at all the different things, he just gets better and better. And then it all culminates kind of in that shot that he gets finally in Into the Wild when Sean Penn, who was
he met, they had done a TV movie. He and Dixie Carter had done a TV movie called The Killing of Randy Webster. And in it was a young, unknown actor, the son of the director Leo Penn, Sean Penn. And Dixie and Hal were so nice to Sean and helping him along and giving him advice that when it was all over, he wrote them this thank you letter. And Hal said it was one of the most beautifully written things he'd ever received. And then years later, he gets a call from this kid who is now Sean Penn. And Sean is directing Into the Wild and asks Hal to play Ron Franz, the aging military veteran, widower. And, of course, Hal gets an Academy Award nomination out of it. So
I just watched that a couple days ago. I had never seen the film. Okay, I'd never seen it, and I was entranced. It's not particularly a film that I would have watched, but yet, you know, everybody in it does such a great job, and there's no doubt that Hal, in that short period of time, just absolutely just takes the screen over.
Oh, he
seriously.
Does. He does. I mean, the last scene, and I'm not going to say anything to give away anything, but the last scene in the car between them is just, you know, it's like, give him the Academy Award nomination just for that scene. Give it to him now.
Oh, absolutely.
Because everything is played out on his face. Everything you need to know is played out on his face. And it's an amazing performance. So, I mean, this is... And, you know, Hal was one of these actors who just, you know, he was incapable of giving a bad performance. You know, he may have done bad things. He may have been in bad movies. But he himself was incapable of giving anything but a wonderful performance.
Very true. Very true. I just got through about 40 minutes of The People Next Door. And it was pretty bad, except for Hal Holbrook.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I said, he's in bad stuff. I mean, he does, you know, but he as an actor, you know, was an actor of immense truth. He always got to the emotional, truthful core of whatever he was playing, you know, whether that was Mark Twain or whether that was a henpecked professor who feeds his wife to a Yeti, you know, whatever he was, he, you know, he gave you that, that strong, wonderful, emotional, core to it is that he, you know, and he was very, like I said, when I reached the point where, you know, I this is kind of a standing joke when I talk to audiences about Mark Twain or they come to see me play as Mark Twain. And I always give credit to Hal. I always, because, you know, a lot of people will tell you, well, I play Mark Twain, you know, and the first thing you kind of want to ask them, well, how do you do that? How do you do it? Well, I researched this and I came up with it. It's like, really? Really? Well, since there are no recordings of his voice, you know, the truth is we have all gone to school on Hal Holbrook. Hal was the one who showed everybody else how to do it. Now, I do not impersonate Hal, and I don't imitate what he does, but certainly I went to school on what he did and studied what he did in order to do what I do. And I remember, now when I started playing Mark Twain at 22, it took me 2 hours to look exactly the way I look today. And if you look at me today, a lot of people do look at me and say, oh, you know, you look a lot like Mark Twain. Well, in truth, nature took over and shortened the makeup process every year. You know, it took me 2 hours when I was 22, and now it's down to about 5 minutes. It's down to about pretty much pick up the cigar, put on the white suit, and go. So, you know, we were right around the time that this was kind of true. Hal and I had dinner in Cleveland at a steakhouse because he would never eat on the day of performance. We'd always see each other the day before because he had a very strict regimen about what he did on the day of performance. He would only eat a certain amount. It was always like soup and things like that. And he always made sure he had the energy and the concentration to perform properly on the night of performance. So the night before, we went out to the steakhouse in Cleveland. And at some point during the dinner, I said to him, you know, Hal, you are always going to be the gold standard when it comes to playing Mark Twain. Nobody is ever going to touch you. Nobody is ever going to get anywhere close to doing what you have done. I said, but you know, there are now two ways I can beat you. And once again, he arched that eyebrow at me. And he said, yeah, watch that. And I said, well, number one, we have reached the point where I can get on stage faster than you. It still takes you 2 hours to look like Mark Twain, but look here. Oh, I got it. I'm on stage performing while you're still in the dressing room. I know it's a small victory, but I'm a small person, and I'll take my victories where I can. He said, well, what's the other one? And I said, well, I'll do something you won't do. Now, this is true. I said, I will do question and answer as Mark Twain. I do a show, and I've offered a show since around 2005, where I have no prepared script. I just meet with an audience, and I say, you can ask me anything you want to ask me. Go right ahead. And the only caveat is you can't ask me about things today. I won't speak for Mark Twain. So if you ask me about the president, I'm going to tell you about Theodore Roosevelt. I know enough about Mark Twain biographically. I know enough about his life. And I have enough stuff to commit it to memory where I can pretty much respond as Mark Twain. And, you know, it's sort of like Mark Twain jazz, you know, so I'm improvising. But I'm using Mark Twain's words. And it always goes very well. You know, it's a fun thing, and it's very, you know, challenging because you don't know who's going to ask what. And Hal just kind of shook his head, and he said, you're right, I'll never do that. And the reason he wouldn't do it is because as an actor, Hal has to be in total control of what he did. He would never play Mark Twain in anybody else's productions. He was asked all the time, all the time. Every script that had the role of Mark Twain in it went to Hal first. And because he couldn't absolutely control what was said and how, he wouldn't do it. That's how carefully he preserved Mark Twain's words and his interpretation of Mark Twain. When Disney did a movie called Mark Twain and Me, which was about Twain in his last years, they of course sent the script to Hal, and of course he turned it down. And then they sent it to Jason Robards. And Robards did it. And I interviewed Robards about playing Mark Twain. And he said, what I can't figure out, he said, I know this script has Hal Holbrook's fingerprints and coffee stains on it. I know that. What I can't figure out is why he's not doing this and not me. And I said, well, I can tell you. Hal has a rule that he won't play Mark Twain in anybody else's production. And Jason Robards said, I like that rule. Hal's made a lot of work for a lot of other actors. So, you know, but that's how seriously Hal took portraying Mark Twain, you know, and he had to be in absolute total control of it and be totally responsible for what came out of his mouth as Mark Twain. So he was a very, you know, Hal would have been the last one to admit that he was a Mark Twain scholar. The first people who would argue that are other Mark Twain scholars. They would tell you immediately, oh, yes, he is. And he's a very important and vital Mark Twain scholar. And there's very few people who understood Mark Twain the way Hal Holbrook did. He knew Mark Twain from the inside. He knew it from playing it for so long. And he understood Mark Twain in a way no academic ever could have understood it. No writer could have understood it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's another reason why he is so incredibly important. When Ken Burns did his
Mark Twain documentary, he didn't have Hal Holbrook do the voice of Mark Twain for that documentary. He didn't have Hal Holbrook narrate it. He used Hal Holbrook as an on-camera commentator on Mark Twain. And some of the best insights into Mark Twain in that documentary come from Hal Holbrook.
How?
And it's not surprising because he really did understand the man in ways that, you know, because he was dramatically interpreting them. So you have to understand the man, Mark Twain, emotionally. He has to understand the character. He has to dissect the guy in order to play him. So this is a way that Hal Holbrook understood Mark Twain and related to Mark Twain in a way that no other biographer or scholar or academic ever could.
If I may, it was probably
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I was going to say it was probably that humility that allowed him to be able to step back, where some people, they're making it about themselves. It sounds to me like what you're saying there is because that humility allowed him to step back and make sure that the focus was always Twain, not Hal Holbrook. And that's a gift.
Well, that's right. That's right. And you know, Hal, the more I learned about Hal as a person, too, the more interesting he becomes. Because, you know, Hal had a very, very troubled childhood. Not just troubled, but you hear people use the phrase Dickensian childhoods to describe very dark and tortured childhoods. If anybody had a Dickensian childhood, it was Hal Holbrook. Number one, his mother deserted him. He never knew his mother. And it wasn't until he was a teenager that he even found out that his mother had been in show business. He didn't know that. His mother had deserted. And there was a trunk of his mother's belongings in his grandmother's basement in Lakewood, Ohio. And he opened the trunk and he found programs and publicity still. And he found out that his mother had been a dancer and performer in vaudeville. And, you know, he didn't know that. And then his father was committed to an asylum when he was still a very young man in Cleveland. And subsequently, he got sent to live with his grandfather in Massachusetts. So he was born in Cleveland. You know, he has he is abandoned by both parents. He goes to live with his grandfather, and he is sent to this school that's right out of Dickens with an abusive headmaster. You know, so he just had, you know, Hal was a he struggled a lot with emotions, and I think this was sort of the journey of an actor. Because actors have to be in touch with their emotions, and I think I think acting was very good for Hal, and I think the other thing that was very, very good for Hal, and I cannot stress this enough, was Dixie. You know, it was the third marriage, and it was the gloriously happy one, and Dixie brought him out. Boy, Dixie drew him out. Dixie was just all of that wonderful Southern charm, which was not faked in any way. She was a completely genuine person. And, you know, Dixie gave Hal permission to show his emotions and to show who he was. And he was just, you know, Dixie was like that. And again, if you were Hal's friend, you were Dixie's friend. I remember being at a party at the Ritz-Carlton, Pasadena, California. And it was in an area of the hotel, which is an old hotel. It looks like it's right out of The Shining. It looks like, you know, you go around a corner of this old hotel, which was built in the teens, you know, more than 100 years ago. And you go around a corner, you expect to find two little girls asking you to go play with them in this hotel. it is that spooky. I remember, I actually once checked into that hotel with Stephen King. I actually, you know, I had been in that hotel many times before. It was his first time. And he was at one desk clerk signing in at the front desk, and I was at another. And he looked around and then he looked at me and he said, "Didn't I write a book about this hotel?" And I said, "Wait till you get inside. Wait till you get inside, you know."
Wow.
When you encounter the two little girls in the hallway, you know. But it was that kind of hotel. But they had this area in the back called the Horseshoe Gardens, and it was very uneven ground. And Dixie, you know, insisted she, you know, Hal wasn't there that night. Dixie was there representing a show that she was on. So she just, you know, took my arm. You don't mind if I take your arm? And we walked the entire evening, so she was steady on her feet. And every time she referred to Hal, she never said just his name. She always referred to him as Mr. Hal Holbrook. "I like doing nice things for Mr. Hal Holbrook." And she had always, you know, he was Hal to me. But it was so charming. It was not in any kind of subservient or not Dixie, you know. But it was just this incredibly charming way of always referring to him. And she'd say, well, you've known Mr. Hal Holbrook for so long. And so Dixie was just a delight. But again, I think that was a very good marriage for Hal. And I think that really, really did help him. He said that. He basically did admit that to me, you know. And, you know, from that point on, Hal was a hugger. I mean, Hal was not a hugger in his youth. But, you know, as, you know, he sure was, you know, afterwards. I mean, he was, you could not see him without him wanting to throw his arms around you. And you know, literally using the words, "I love you." You know, literally to his friends. Saying, you know, "Well, you know how much I love you," you know. As he was not going to let anything go unsaid, which, considering how he grew up, considering his childhood, and considering where he came from, he really did overcome a lot, you know, not only to become a great actor, but also just to be more genuinely in touch with his emotions.
Well, that's really something. And, you know, I really appreciate you coming on, Mark. Because generally when we do these memorials, we'll talk about the work. But to give this type of insight into the person himself, I think that's a great thing. And I really appreciate you being on, because I know you're still grieving over this. And grief takes a lot of time.
It really, I'll tell you the truth, guys. You know, is like today I had to go drive over from where I live in Cuyahoga Falls to Kent, Ohio. It takes about, you know, about 20 minutes to drive over. And I thought, you know, I would listen to some music, which was Mark Twain. So I put in the soundtrack to the Broadway musical Big River, which is Huckleberry Finn. And there's a song in there about friendship, which Huck and Jim sing to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And
the song.
Yes. Well, and Hal had the most crystal beautiful blue eyes. And my eyes are deep, dark, dark brown. And one of the lyrics in the song is, you know, "I see the same world through brown eyes that you see through blue, but we're worlds apart." I lost it completely, guys.
Oh,
I almost had to pull over.
I can believe it.
Because, you know, it just all came crashing in on me at that moment. So, you know, I mean, it's like it sneaks up on you when you kind of least expect it. And that was kind of like a moment when it did. And I was like, yeah, I shouldn't be listening to this right now.
Well, one thing I say to a lot of people, Mark, and I'll say it to you now, is that, you know, Hal certainly has passed, but he's always going to be there for you. He's in your heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're never going to miss him.
That's without question.
No, not in that sense.
No,
because
there's
a memory.
I don't know.
I don't
know. You know, and in truth, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I don't know if it means anything, brother, but I got a lump in my throat now, man. Like, that really choked me up. That's, yeah. I'm sorry. Go on.
Well, I listen. Like I said, I gave way to it. I unabashedly and unashamedly.
Yeah, good for you, man. Good for you.
Like nothing. And I know there are going to be those moments, you know, when I think of something or think of a moment where that will happen. And by the way, I mean, look, I'm not alone here. Hal had a wonderful gift for friendship. He had a remarkable gift for friendship. And one of the great things was also, you know, was sharing that friendship with other people who knew Hal and understood that and who he was. And, you know, in 2009, this is one of my favorite memories of Hal, by the way. In 2009, every 4 years, there is this gathering of the Mark Twain scholarship community in Elmira, New York, at the Center for Mark Twain Studies in upstate New York. And every 4 years, there is a conference in which all of the leading Mark Twain scholars from around the world gather and give papers about Mark Twain. So it's primarily an academic conference, but it is open to anybody who just loves Mark Twain. Anybody can go. I went the first time in 1997, and I didn't go 4 years earlier. I was people were saying you should go in 93, and I said no. You know, I don't have any credentials. I haven't written about anything important about Mark Twain. I don't belong there. And everybody said, no, you're exactly the type of person you should go and all this. And, well, I was foolish. I should have listened. I should have gone. Because 4 years later, I did go. And the reason I went was in between 93 and 97, my first book about Mark Twain was published. Mark My Words, Mark Twain on Writing was published by St. Martin's Press. And I thought, well, now I have an entree. I belong there. Well, that was a foolish way to think. I should have just gone in 93 because it's a wonderfully welcoming group, warm, wonderful. So I went in 97, and then 4 years later in 2001, I started delivering papers at the conference. I started giving talks on Mark Twain. So I gave a talk in 2001, and then I gave a talk in 2005. And then as to the 2009 conference started to approach, I knew what the topic of what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to in some way commemorate and celebrate what Hal had accomplished with his one-man show. And I wanted to do a paper on Mark Twain Tonight. So I called him and I said, listen, you know, I won't do this if it would make you uncomfortable. But I'd really want to do this paper about what you've done. And so, you know, I said, I guess I'm asking your permission. And Hal said, I tell you what, you write it, I'll come listen to you deliver it. And he kept his promise. So in 2009, I delivered with him sitting in the front row. I gave this paper about Mark Twain Tonight. And afterwards, he got up and he talked. He gave a little talk about what Twain, the Twain scholarship meant to him over the years, and how we need somebody to tell us the truth, not to twist it, not to make it their own thing, but, and this was before alternative facts we're talking about. And he said, you know, and there's only one person in our history who has ever done that, and that is Mark Twain. And it's a wonderful little speech. It's on YouTube. You can find this speech on YouTube. I love this. I love the YouTube clip of it, by the way, because it ends with the two of us embracing. We got one of those famous hugs. One of those famous Oliver hugs is at the conclusion of this little talk. And then the entire talk I gave is actually posted. It was recorded, and so it's posted. Both the text of it and the recording of it is posted at the Center for Mark Twain Studies site. If anybody wants to listen to it. But at the end, Hal gives this little bit of talk. But it was so wonderful because he was on the campus for the whole conference. So it was like a 3-day conference, and he was there. So he got to hear from all of these leading Mark Twain scholars basically saying, I wouldn't be a Mark Twain scholar if it wasn't for you. My interest in Mark Twain was awakened by you. And he, over and over, it was so much love And, you know, and if you've got time for this, I'll tell you a little story. The Mark Twain, when I went to the Mark Twain conference for the very first time in 1997, all of the three conferences end up at a place called Quarry Farm, which is where Mark Twain used to spend his summers. He used to pack up his family in Hartford, Connecticut, and head to Quarry Farm, which was his sister-in-law's farm in upstate New York. And he didn't get much writing done in Hartford because Hartford was social. And he got most of his writing done during the summer months in Elmira, New York. Most of the books were actually written there. And his sister-in-law built him this special little study. It was an octagonal study, which was built along the lines of a pilot house on a Mississippi riverboat. And she put it up on a bluff a little bit above the house. And he would walk up there to his study, spend the day, do his writing, then come back down to the house. Well, the study itself has since been moved down to the campus of Elmira College, but the site of the study, the foundation stones, are still up there. And the area where it was is all overgrown. Well, every conference in Elmira now ends with a picnic up at Quarry Farm. All the scholars on Saturday night go up to Quarry Farm, and there's this wonderful picnic up there. And when I was there the first time in 1997, there was a Twain scholar from Nevada named Joe McCullough. And he came up to me and said, "You're not a cigar smoker, are you?" And I said, "Well, I've been known to indulge." And he said, "Are you packing?" And I said, yes, I've got a couple of Ashtons with me." And he said, "Oh, Ashtons." He said, a graduate student once gave me a couple Ashtons, and in there was a smoke. I saw the visions of a teaching assistant when I saw that. I said, "That was wonderful." And I said, "What do you ask?" He said, "Well, we're trying to get 8 cigar smokers together, and we want to go up to the site of the study at the end of the picnic." And he said, "This is top secret because they won't let us because it's kind of dangerous in the dark to go up there." He said, "But we're trying to get 8 cigar smokers to go up there." And so I'm in. So as the picnic was winding down, the 8 of us trekked up to the site of the original study in the dark. It's amazing we didn't break our full necks. And we got up, and then each of us took one side of the octagonal study. We each stood where one side of the study would be, and we all lit our cigars at the same time. I know John Byrd from North Carolina was there. I know Joe McCullough was there, and I was there. And we let the smoke waft up to the trees. And we looked up, and there were these two amazingly tall trees which sort of forked over us. And as the smoke reached the fork, this lightning bolt came through the sky. And we just looked at each other. And Joe McCullough looked at me and said, "You have got to figure we have more fun than the Kafka Society. This is just too So we trekked back down, and word very, very quickly spread that we had done this. So 4 years later, in 2001, I thought everybody had forgotten about it. 4 years later, everybody's coming up to us. "You guys going to do the cigar thing again? Are you going to do the cigar ceremony?" So the next 4 years later, there was, you know, maybe 25, instead of the 8 of us, there's maybe 25 people up there. 4 years later, almost everybody went up. I mean, men, women, dogs, everybody was smoking cigars. Everybody. In 2009, guess who goes up with us? Hal Holbrook.
Hal
makes the trip up for the cigar. So the 4th cigar ceremony is in 2009. Hal's on campus to hear me deliver the paper. So he goes up, and he stands in the middle of that where the study used to be, where Mark Twain used to write, and he starts telling us stories about meeting Twain's daughter, Clara, and all these wonderful things. It also ends with a singing ceremony. John Byrd, the first time we went up, John Byrd had brought his mandolin. John is a wonderful mandolin player.
So he had brought his mandolin that first night we'd gone up. After that, it sort of turned into a song ceremony, and John and I sort of lead the song ceremony. And songs differ each year, but one song that is a constant and is a must that has is part of the ceremony every 4 years is "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," the old bluegrass
yes.
standard.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and Hal joined us on that. There are pictures of Hal singing with us, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken." And tonight, it feels like the circle's been broken. Tonight, it feels a little bit like that circle has been reduced a little bit. But I know that the next conference is in 2022, that when we all gather up there, Hal is going to be very much on our mind. And the song, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," will have a special resonance in that night air in August in Elmira, New York. It will have a little bit of special resonance the next time.
If I would have known you were going to tell this story, I would have downloaded "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" and finished the podcast with that. I do have a song. Picked out though. One thing I want to do very quickly, because I know Limes may have to leave here relatively soon. I just wanted to go through the three of us and to pick, you know, a couple of films. One maybe your favorite, and then one that people don't know about that Hal did a great job in, whether it be a TV movie or, you know, the miniseries Lincoln and North and South and so on and so forth. Let's start with Limes. Give us like your favorite Hal Holbrook, and then sort of like an under the radar Hal Holbrook.
Okay. Darn. You know, it's so hard to pick a favorite because, you know, I love, obviously, I'm a horror guy. I love The Fog. I love him as Father Malone in The Fog. I love him as Lieutenant Briggs in Magnum Force. But I think, this one obviously goes out to you, especially there, Mark. I think if I were to think of a scene, one particular movie and one particular scene that really sums up for me what a fantastic actor Hal Holbrook was, it would definitely be Capricorn One. And the scene where he's trying to, obviously, where he's got all the astronauts together, you know, Brolin, O.J. Simpson, and what's his name there? What's the other guy? The Sam Waterston?
Waterston, Sam Waterston.
Yeah. And, you know, he's trying to talk them into it, and it's coming down to him and James Brolin. Right. And, you know, these guys were friends. We know that they were close friends. And the scene starts with him, you know, basically trying to convince him, talk him into, look, this is why we got to do this scene on Mars. And it's not working. And then it goes to manipulation to, look, you know what, guys, we got to do this. You got to do this. You got no choice. And coming down to that scene where, and again, this goes out to you because obviously you are a close friend of the guy, the two friends facing off. And Brolin's basically saying to him, like Hal Holbrook said, like, you know, your families, guys, there's a device on this plane that's going to go off. All your families are together. If you don't do this, your families are going to die. And Brolin's basically looking at him. He's like, you wouldn't tell me you wouldn't do that. And it comes to that point where he's got to choose between, look, this is my friend or this bigger picture. What means the most to me? And that just that you talked about his timing when he just pauses and just looks at him and says, I can't do that, bro. I just, every freaking time I see that scene, there are certain scenes in movies. One of them is Charlton Heston pounding the sand at the end of Planet of the Apes. And that scene with Hal Holbrook, that just brings the goosebumps up for me. Like, I just, it just kills me. It kills me. And I know that, and my second one is, and I know that you said, Carl, try and do one that's off the radar, but I can't. I can't because I love him so much. And again, because of what Merck said there, him and Fritz Weaver together, talk about two friggin' giants. Like, they just own that story. And I guess there's a reason why that story is the longest story on the Creepshow on the movie, because how can you condense those two guys into 5 or 10 minutes? It's no. So I'm going to sign off there, and I'm going to pull back and pass it back over to Carl. But Mark, from me to you, that's what your friend meant to me. I just think he is just fucking fantastic. Right.
Well, and remember what the most famous line from in some way though, the most repeated line in the crate is, which is, what a friend's for.
Yeah, you're right. So, exactly. Exactly. And the two of them playing chess as they're saying that, and they're making their moves. And like, mm-hmm. Oh God, it kills me. Carl, you got to take this, man, because I'm getting goosebumps. Go for it.
Okay. All the President's Men. You know, all of these great films that he was in, certainly, you know, he played Abraham Lincoln, played John Adams. He had a thing for government figures. And one of my favorite movies of his, I must have been about 14 or 15. It was on HBO. We had the early HBO in Bradford, Pennsylvania. We were one of the test markets. And I saw Wild in the Streets, if I'm not mistaken, was his second movie.
Okay, he's awfully he did young. Group. He is, yeah.
But he played
and
a young.
And I think he had done a Disney movie before that. Yeah.
Yeah, that I think actually you're right about that. But he's very young. He plays sort of a Kennedy type of senator. He's a candidate anyway, and picks up.
Christopher Jones.
Thank you, Christopher Jones. Mm-hmm. And he's a rock star, and Hal thinks he's going to use him to get the youth vote, but it's the other way around. And right. As the movie goes on, and you see what happens, Hal Holbrook turns into a very tragic figure, and. You know, it's played as a satire and a musical too, but still that sadness comes through and that tragedy comes through and the hubris and everything of this character, Senator Johnny Fergus, I think is the name of his character. And it is a fantastic role. It really is. And it was one of the things along with the 67 Mark Twain, I saw this and I just said, wow. So that to me is one of my favorites of his. But if I'm talking about a movie, go ahead, Mark, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Carl. You don't finish up there.
Okay.
I want to hear that.
But if I'm going to talk about a movie that's really under the radar, and again, we had HBO. So all these Canadian films would come in, you know, and really, like, not know what they are or that sort of thing. And I believe it's one of the few movies, not miniseries, but movies, where he had the lead role. And it's a film called Rituals. Are you familiar with it, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
It's considered, or it's, you know, it's sort of considered the Canadian Deliverance. The story is these five doctors, and they know each other and they're friends, and they always go to a fishing trip. And they go to this very secluded area, and they are, the first thing that happens is that their shoes are stolen. And they have somebody basically messing with them. And they don't know what's happening, and of course, everything just falls apart. But the change from where we meet Hal at the beginning of the movie till the end, and it's also a Vietnam and a Korean allegory, it's amazing. He's amazing. And the film, his co-star is Lawrence Dane, and Lawrence actually produced this film and also basically made sure that Hal would star in it, talked him into it. And it's probably his most atypical role he ever did. And I think it's one of his best. Seriously.
No, unfortunately, it, you know, like I say, you could. It's not well known, right? It's not one that is. But that's the thing about discovering Hal's work. It's like I said, there's no role that you can look at that he did, even in bad movies, where you just look at it and go, "Oh, he didn't have it," or "He was, you know, he was wrong for that." He found the truth in it. He found the, like, you know, in the movie you're talking about, which is, you know, very much a survival story. And it is a, you know, and again, it is not something you think of Hal Holbrook being in. You
no.
know, it's not no. one of those kinds of movies that you think of, well, this is a quote unquote Hal Holbrook movie.
It's very
so
atypical.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yep. Yep, very much, and you know, and of course, you know, it was shot, you know, in that like northern Ontario area where you really do get the sense of the wilderness almost, you know, the how isolated they are.
Mm-hmm.
So no, it's and again, it's one of those intriguing movies, and it was in that span of time where Hal was doing horror movies. You know, there's this kind of subset to his career, that kind of Rituals and The Fog and Creepshow will fall into. And again, you know, it's a kind of thing where I think he thought, you know, that it tagged him more as somebody who was doing things commercially. And it's like, you know, and it's unfortunate because it also goes to, you know, this is a discussion for a whole nother evening, but you know, something that I've talked about quite a lot, which is that, you know, horror is one of the most difficult things to do well. It is one of the most difficult things to pull off and pull, and it doesn't get the respect. You know, it's the horror and humor thing again, where if you do horror and humor, you know, everybody kind of looks down on what you're doing as if you are in some, you know, sub-basement of literature or something, and yet among writers and artists, they know that these two forms are the absolute hardest forms to do and do well. And that's one of the reasons, you know, like I would kind of argue with Hal about the horror movies, which is to say, you know, this is a very difficult genre to do well, you know, and he wasn't, you know, the film you were talking about, you know, is that, okay, you know, Peter Carter isn't the most well-known director, but, you know, Hal did work with John Carpenter and George Romero. You know, he did work with some of the leading, you know, artists in the field at the time. And
absolutely.
You know, I think he thought, you know, kind of, and it may have, he may have been right. It may indeed had hurt his reputation in Hollywood a little bit. But to me, it burnishes his reputation because that is a tremendously difficult form to do and be good in. And he was very good in all of those movies.
I would say about Rituals is that, A, I don't consider it a horror movie. It's a survival movie, which is different. You know, it's a deliverance film. Okay? But the thing about this movie is that if I were to see Hal, I would say, you know, you probably, you know, poo-poo this film and that. This is one of your best works.
Yeah.
It really is. It is a crackerjack of a movie. It's 96 minutes.
And you know,
there's not one wasted moment, and it just ratchets up the terror, and it just is so good. And you can see things dissolve, the friendships, and it's just, it's heartbreaking. It seriously is.
Well, I think of it as a you know, kind of a survival thriller film. You know, I wouldn't take it out of the horror realm. It's because I think it's a horror film the same way that Steven Spielberg's Duel, the Richard Matheson story, mm-hmm. is a horror story.
Because
it too is a survival story, and it too is not technically supernatural in any way. But it's one of those things. Like, you know, my last book was on the Shawshank Redemption, and you know, I was being interviewed once. About it, somebody called it, you know, kind of an outlier among Stephen King's stories because it's not a horror story. And I said, says who? You know, I mean, really? Can you think of a bigger horror story than what Andy goes through in The Shawshank Redemption? Just because horror is not supernatural does not mean it's not horror. Silence of the Lambs is not supernatural. Psycho is not supernatural. But are you going to tell me those are not horror movies just because they deal with the horror of the human condition or the sometimes inhuman condition?
Yeah.
You know, so, mm-hmm. you know, and I think this with a level, I mean, this is where horror can get at it, whether it gets at it with true supernatural or you know, the horror of the human animal. This is where, you know, horror makes extraordinarily profound comments on human beings. And that is something which Hal is very good at as an actor. His roles make comment, make you, you know, wonder about yourself and make you wonder about who we are. We like, as Mark Twain did. You know, it's very much mm-hmm. in the tradition of Mark Twain. So, you know, I agree, you know.
Okay, so I'm going to pass it over to you, Mark, and just give us, like, your favorite performance of Powell's is either in TV or film, and then like, an under-the-radar one, too.
Well, you know, it's going to be very, very tough for me not to say, you know, Mark Twain tonight. I mean, because it is – and it's available now on DVD. It's available through KOTOR Video on DVD, so anybody can sort of own this amazing performance. The makeup. Just alone.
Okay, so let's forget about Mark Twain. I should have said that at the beginning.
Well, the amazing thing about that special is it was filmed as both a TV and theatrical performance at the same time. It had a live audience, but the live audience was sitting in a soundstage. So it looked like a theater, and in some ways it was a theater, but it was also a controlled soundstage experience. So the sound and the lighting could be perfect because you can't really shoot in a theater and get 100%. So they shot it. David Susskind was one of the producers, and they shot it on a soundstage. But they had an audience there for a theatrical reaction and response to what he was doing. So it was like a combination of both. It was part television and part theater, number one. Secondly, you know, Hal's makeup was theatrical makeup. It was always designed to be seen under the harsh glare of theatrical stage lights. Well, television brings you right up close. And the theatrical makeup, the makeup that Hal was doing to make himself look like a 70-year-old Mark Twain, wasn't going to cut it. So they brought in Dick Smith, work with Hal. So they worked with Hal's theatrical makeup, and then Smith added a whole level of makeup to what he was doing. And you get this amazing – he never looked more like Mark Twain than he did in that 1967 special. So that's another reason. And then it's a perfect reflection of what the show was at that time, at that moment. It has some of the funniest things that he ever did. It has a wonderful selection from Huckleberry Finn. And it has some of the really strong – 1960s social commentary, because he was putting in stuff about, you know, the war and about
the race riots and things like that, and the civil rights movement. And he was making sure all of that stuff went in. So that, you know, it's going to be very tough. I, anytime I get cocky and start to think I'm pretty good at playing Mark Twain, and after 43 years, maybe you'd be excused for thinking, you know, I'm getting pretty good at this. You know, the audience is like me, and it feels like I'm really in control of this. I sit down and watch that 1967 special and go, nope, not even close. Not even on your best day are you within visual distance of how far out this guy was. It's always it keeps you humble. And remember, the last time I watched it was just this past October. My wife and daughter and I got to spend a week at Quarry Farm. As I was a scholar in residence, and I was there to deliver the a lecture. And you get to stay in the house if you're the guest lecturer. So we were there for a week, and one night we watched Mark Twain Tonight in the house where Mark Twain used to spend his summers. It was quite an experience to do that. And then, you know, it also was kind of, I just sat there, and even as many times as I've seen it, and as many times as I've played Mark Twain, I sat there and just with my mouth open, still marveling at how incredible his performance is in that. So, you know, I mean, as much as I like him as Deep Throat, and, you know, he's only on camera, and all the President's Men, he's only on camera for a few minutes total.
Yeah.
But he hangs as a presence over that movie, and Robert Redford knew he needed Hal Holbrook to play that part. He went after Holbrook to play it because he knew he needed an actor of such gravitas and weight, and somebody who was so distinctly American in what he did and could be. I mean, he's never seen in full. He's always seen in the shadows. I mean, it was a brave performance. You know, a lot of actors would have said, "I've only got so many lines. I'm only get somebody else." You know, and in some ways, it turns out to be the most important role in the film. You know, so I mean, it's hard to know, but nothing's ever going to knock out Mark Twain Tonight. And my favorite underrated or sort of lesser known performance is the one I've already mentioned, which is Murder by Natural Causes. If you haven't seen Murder by Natural Causes, if anybody is, go find it, because this is a tour de force performance. And every time you think you know what's going on, you don't. Barry Bostwick, Catherine Ross, and Richard Anderson, who played the killer in the second Kolchak movie, Night Strain. You know, it's a wonderful cast, but it is really Hal's show, and he plays a mentalist. He plays a psychic, and you're never quite sure if he's genuine or not. And all the while, and his wife is plotting to kill him. And it's just the story turns and revolves. And again, it was written by Levinson and Link, who created Columbo. They did a trilogy of movies. They were great mystery fans, obviously. And they did three movies, trying to write like the ultimate mysteries. And it became their trilogy. And one was called Rehearsal for Murder, which was set in a theater. And Robert Preston was the lead. Then there was one called Guilty Conscience with Anthony Hopkins and Blythe Danner. And both of them are quite good. But neither of them is as good as Murder by Natural Causes. Oh, my goodness. It is a great mystery, and it is a great role for Hal. And, by the way, it wasn't the only time he worked with Levinson and Link. You know, one of the greatest and most important titles on his resume is another TV movie that he did before Murder by Natural Causes called That Certain Summer with Martin Sheen.
Right.
And Hal Holbrook and Martin Sheen, at a time when you could hardly even say the word homosexual on television, play a homosexual couple. And it was the first depiction of that on network television and shown in not a insulting or stereotypical way. It was just shown as two men in a relationship with each other and devoted to each other. And it's an amazing performance. And then many, many years later, Hal comes back and guest stars on The West Wing with Martin Sheen as the president. And he plays this mentor to Josiah Bartlett, the president that Martin Sheen plays, and the only person in Washington who completely intimidates Martin Sheen. He just shows up and looks at him, and he intimidates him. And they reunited many years later, which is very nice. And they also remained in touch. Two Ohio boys from different parts of Ohio. Hal was from Cleveland, and Martin Sheen was from Dayton, but they're both from Ohio, and they both end up in this incredible movie and a very important movie. Like I say, you hear they say this was a landmark film, and so this truly was a landmark movie.
Well, there's no question of that. I've done a couple of podcasts on LGBTQ cinema, and both times that certain summer.
You can't get around that.
Mentioned that particular film. Yeah. No question.
There's no getting around it. And again, just also, you can't give Hal and Martin Sheen enough credits for just courage to do it. Because a lot of actors would have just said, no, I don't need this. I don't need to be getting anywhere near this.
Right.
They did it, and they did it at such a high level. I mean, now it looks a little quaint, and now it looks a little, we've seen so much since then. But, in some ways, this was one of the movies that was the headwaters to changing attitudes.
And you got to remember time, right?
Yeah. And I'll mention one other thing about performance on Hal. I mean, we've talked a lot about his different types of roles. But we talked about Into the Wild. We've talked about different things he's done. I think it would be remiss not to mention The Senator. Because you mentioned Wild in the Streets, and then shortly after Wild in the Streets, Hal was again cast as a senator, a very much Kennedy-like senator. And in this case, it was an idealistic junior senator, and this was part of the rotating elements of a overall series that was called The Bold Ones.
I remember that very well, and I remember the series very well.
The lawyers, they had the doctors. And for one season, they added the senator, and it was Hal, and they only did like 8 episodes. And this also is out on – you can get the 8 episodes on DVD. There's a box set on it. And it's – Hal won his first Emmy for this. this was his first Emmy, was playing this part. But they did stories – Kent State happened while this was on the air. And they did a show about the Kent State shootings, which is incredible. And they had great actors. They paired up their guest stars. There's one episode where Burgess Meredith plays his rival senator, and he and Hal are doing this political dance for the entire episode, and it comes down to who's going to win. And it's an amazing thing. And it had Burgess Meredith, another actor from Cleveland, two Cleveland boys duking it out. So the senator is like, was Hal's very young, this is the beginning of his TV career. And I always say to people who, if you want to know how versatile Hal Holbrook is, always remember that he won 5 Emmys, and not one of them was for playing Mark Twain. So if you think of him only as Mark Twain, just remember he got 5 Emmys, and one of them's for playing Lincoln, one of them's for Pueblo, and one of them's for the senator. Right there you have some. In some ways, there are some actors who just got better work in – Richard Matheson always said this as a writer, that in a lot of ways he was better served by TV than he was by movies, that the TV versions of his work – were always better. He had great TV movies like Duel and Trilogy of Terror and The Night Stalker, and he had all of this great stuff in TV movies, but the movie stuff was, never as satisfying to him. And, you could kind of make the argument that TV treated Hal better than the movies did, because he wasn't classically a leading man type, but he could find these amazing, challenging roles in television. And some of the songs we've talked about the senator and that certain summer and things like that. You know, he got some really great chances from television.
Yeah. North and South, you know, Lincoln. I mean, just amazing work on TV. Amazing work on TV.
Yep.
Mark, I want to thank you very, very much for coming on. We're going to wrap this up here. I just want to give you one last shot at a remembrance or any final words you have to say about Hal before we get into what we like to call housekeeping.
Well, I've said it all. I just, you know, I will, you know, remember, you know, with a, just warm smiles and more memories. There is no shortage of those from all of the years of, you know, getting, you know, I'll tell you one last story, you know, because in.
Okay. I'm always up for a story.
Very quickly, okay? Because, you know, Dixie was from West Tennessee. Dixie was from the west part of Tennessee. Now, I married my wife, Sarah Shulman, who is a wonderful actress, is from East Tennessee. So Hal and I both married actresses from Tennessee. You know, both very warm, talented people. And I knew Dixie, and I knew Hal, and Sarah had met Hal, but Sarah had never met Dixie. There was never a chance sort of for the two of them to meet. Well, Hal and Dixie came to Akron to perform Love Letters, the play that you sit on stage and you read the script. It's letters between two people who've known each other forever. And so you sit at the stage, and as these two part, you read it, you know. So they were coming to do Love Letters at this huge theater, E.J. Thomas Hall in Akron. Now, right before they got to town, Sarah and I were asked to perform it at a theater called Coach House Theater in Akron, you know. So I called up Hal, and I said, well, bad news, Hal. And he said, what's that? And I said, well, I just feel so sorry for you and Dixie having to follow Sarah and I in this town. We just did Love Letters, so we've ruined the town for you. You know, there's no way you two can follow us, you know. Now, Coach House seats 90 people. E.J. Thomas seats 3,000. So I was joking. You know? And he got it. I mean, he was laughing because he knew, you know. He said, you know, come see Love Letters, and then afterwards we'll all go out to dinner. So, you know, we went to the green room afterwards, and then the four of us went to this. And Rich Costable, his stage manager, went with us. He was a great guy, and he was his stage manager forever. The five of us went out to dinner, and it turned into the Sarah Dixie Show. Hal and I just sat back and enjoyed it. Because now, Dixie kept telling to Sarah, you know, Sarah, honey, call me Dixie. And she'd say, yes, Miss Carter. And said, Sarah, call me Dixie. And he said, yes, Miss Carter. Now, Dixie, being from Tennessee, finally got it and looked at Sarah and said, Sarah, honey, you can't do it, can you? And she said, no, Miss Carter, I sure can't. I was always interested to tell people, call them as a Miss or Mrs. When I was really, that's all right. You just go right ahead and you call me anything you want. And it was just a hoot watching the two of them interact and getting to know each other. It was such a warm evening. It was such a wonderful evening. And Hal and I basically almost didn't say anything the whole night. You know, we always, you know, carried the conversation, but we just enjoyed it thoroughly. And at one point I just said to him, you know, there's kind of great wisdom in marrying actresses from Tennessee, isn't there, Hal? And he agreed. And I think that's one thing he would, you know, would always say. Like I said, Dixie was just it's we are talking about Hal, but I really, really can't say enough about Dixie too, you know. Because she was a wonderful person. So yes, and to this day, you know, whenever I, you know, with around Sarah,
you know, and we refer to Dixie, it's Miss Carter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me it was Dixie, but for Sarah it had to be Miss Carter.
Miss Carter. That's a great story. That's a great story.
Yeah. Well,
Marty,
like you said, there was
go
if
ahead,
I could
guys.
Jump in there for a second, Carl. Just for a second,
go
because
for
I know you're going to do housekeeping. I just want to say from my own self, Mark, obviously this is a really, you know, obviously a tough time for you, and thank you so much for sharing these memories with us. For me personally, I know obviously Carl said that, but like Hal was a huge part of my life growing up, and I feel honored to have been on this show tonight. Thank you.
Well, no, thank you. It's been fun sharing this. You know, it's like sharing a friend. It's like, you know, and believe me, you know, I was the one who was blessed and honored to have known him for as long as I did, you know. You know, there were times when it, you know, because you got to remember, I'm like, you know, this, I was that fanboy first. I was that nervous fanboy in the corner of the hotel room. And so there's part of me that has never quite gotten over the fact that, you know, this did turn into friendship. And, you know, I mean, not just because of Mark Twain, but also because of, again, valuing Hal Holbrook as the complete actor and the complete performer, and then understanding what a, you know, he was a great actor, but he was a great friend.
For sure. Beautiful.
You know, I said this at the beginning, and you know, when someone passes, there, you know, grief is personal, and I know that this will process for you, and we just want you to know, and personally for me, that this has been a wonderful, wonderful sharing of Hal and your friend Hal, and not just his work, but who he was. And for that,
yes,
I can't thank you enough, Mark. Seriously.
No.
Well, like I said, I thank you, you know, because it's nice to be able to, you know, it feels like you're sharing him with the world a little bit and letting people know, you know, this is, a little bit of who he was. And I'm sure anybody who knew Hal could have done the same thing I did tonight, by the way, just because he was kind of that special. And he had a, you know, an amazing circle of friends, and my goodness, you know, it's, as you said, it's not going to stop, you know, it will go
it's
on.
Not. Absolutely. So I'm going to do a quick housekeeping, as we like to call it. So tomorrow we are going to release a new series, we recorded it a couple of days ago. We're doing Doc and I are doing commentary watches on sexploitation films and stuff like that from the 60s and 70s. Not hardcore, but softcore. And it's Scratch's Sleaze Box. And we'll be doing that every week on Saturday. Now, coming up on Tuesday for the ISF podcast, we have Tim Ritter. Tim Ritter is going to be joining us. He is a director who did a lot of DIY for video and DVD in the 90s. He's still directing today. Very micro budget and lots of fun. He also works with Joel Weinkoop, who was a guest a couple weeks ago at the ISF podcast. On Wednesday, Rachel is going down the rabbit hole again, and we're going to be talking about singing comedians. And today we got the news that another great actor passed away, and that would be Christopher Plummer, of course. And on Thursday, we'll be doing a retrospective of his work, and I'm very pleased to announce that film critic Noel Vera will be with us on that particular podcast, and we'll be going through Christopher Plummer's work, and that's I'm still reeling from that news today, you know, and another gentleman who had been around for quite a while too, I think he was like 91 or 92 when he passed. So anyway, that's what we have planned for Deviant Legion. Again, I want to thank Mark for coming on tonight very, very much. And Limes, as always, mm-hmm. it's a pleasure to have you on. You have a show coming up next Monday. Do you know what you're doing yet or not?
Yeah, you know what? That's okay. So this month is Women in Horror Month. So I got a few things going. Obviously, Dee Wallace is going to be on the show on March 1st. I have a mystery guest that I'm just trying to iron out the kinks that should be on next Monday, but I don't want to say anything at the moment. All I'm going to say is stay tuned. I'll drop the news as soon as I can. And I am actually going to be conducting an interview next week that'll be uploaded to Terror with a Twist of Limes with a UK director, producer, writer, and actor, Emma Dark. So that's what I have on the boil right now, Carl.
Okay, good. So we want to thank everyone for coming on. We're going to end the show as we do all the memoriams. I have two songs that generally pick one or the other, and this one is called "Out of the World." Out of This World by Loudon Wainwright. And if Mark, you may not want to listen to this because you may be crying your eyes out by the end of it. But listen, thank you all for listening. Really appreciate it. We'll see you on Tuesday for the ISF podcast. And have a good weekend, everyone. Good night.
Good night, and God bless everybody.
Good night,
everybody.
It's almost time now, it's almost over. Sooner than later, I'll be dead and gone. Out of this world. Out of this world. And I guess that I'll miss some of the good times, but it'll be fine for me to be moving on out of this world. Out of this world. Out of this world and into another, a kinder world, a world that's better. Out of this world. Out of my mind and out of my body. Nothing will hurt me. I'll be so happy out of this world. Out of this world. And you all will miss me. Then you'll forget me. But that won't upset me, 'cause nothing will get to me out of this world. Out of this world. Out of this world and into another. Kinder world, a world that's better, out of this world. It's almost time now, it's almost over, sooner than later. later, I'll be dead and gone out of this world.
Good night, everyone.